This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years of craftsmanship, April 3rd through 30th. For a store location near you, you can visit www.peets.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
Good morning. This is the KABU Morning News for Monday, April 17th, 2006. I'm Marlise Franklin.
I'm Latoya Hudson.
Coos Bay is moving closer to hosting a liquid natural gas facility. The Supreme Court today will take up the question of OGF workplace discrimination. In Tel Aviv, a suicide bomber killed 7 people in retaliation for the violence Israeli forces have inflicted on the Palestinian people. Portland area weather today, partly cloudy with a chance of showers, high 50 to 55. Tonight, partly cloudy, low in the 30s.
When Oregonians file their state income tax returns today, they'll be on track to pay $10.6 billion over 2 years. That is nearly 90% of the tab for state government. But corporations that do business in Oregon will pay only $705 million. The disparity results from 2 decades of decisions by state lawmakers to recast tax policies to favor corporate interests, particularly big manufacturers and large out-of-state companies. Despite election year rhetoric that businesses are overtaxed, no state asks businesses to pay a lighter share of its state budget than Oregon does. According to the Council on State Taxation, which represents big businesses, instead Oregon households shoulder the tax burden for schools, health care, public safety, and other state services. The trend comes into stark relief this year when a middle-income family in the Portland suburbs pays more in state taxes than they would pay in a typical western state, but gets below-average services, including bigger class sizes and less college financial aid for children, according to the Oregonian. Intel Oregon's largest employer and company that paid $50 million in taxes a year will see its 2006 bill fall to a fraction of that amount, potentially as low as $10.
As much as $14 million this year. The state will learn today when a payment is due whether 3 of the major companies will argue that they've lost sales to smaller companies as a result of an 8-year-old national tobacco settlement. At stake is money the state is counting on to help fund the Oregon Health Plan for low-income residents. State officials have pledged to sue to get the money. Under a 1998 settlement between 46 states, including Oregon, and the 4 largest tobacco companies, the companies agreed to pay the state's $246 billion. That was to compensate for costs of treating smoking-related illnesses. In return, the state agreed to give up their lawsuits against the industry. The agreement allows the companies to reduce that payment if they lose market share as a result of the settlement. Last month, an independent economic consultant concluded that the major tobacco companies are losing sales to smaller companies because of costs imposed by the settlement. That finding would allow companies to reduce their payments this year by $1.2 billion nationally, about $14 million in Oregon.
Coos County was until last year the largest county in the United States without a natural gas service, but it could become a major exporting point if plans are realized to build a liquefied natural gas terminal at Coos Bay and a 36-inch pipeline. That big line would bring gas from ocean-going tankers for distribution eastward to a trunk line running down the flanks of Cascade Range, and then to markets in the west, which are using natural gas at a rapid clip. Just a year ago, Coos County official opened a smaller 12-inch pipeline to bring natural gas services westward for distribution to homes, businesses, and industries in the area. Whichever way the gas flows, it brings controversy to Coos County. Construction of the smaller line from Roseburg on the Interstate 5 corridor was contentious and featured environmental lawsuits, the firing of one contractor, and lawsuits, not all of which have been resolved. Now residents have objected to plan for surveys for a route for the bigger pipeline from the proposed liquefied natural gas terminal.
Seattle paint companies, shipyards, and other industries release more than 126,000 pounds of pollution in 2004. It is an improvement over the previous year and another reason to maintain the program tracking the releases. The pollution tally was reported this week by the Environmental Protection Agency, which recently proposed scaling back the effort. Factories on the Duwamish River spew fewer toxins than they did a decade ago, but a new report from the EPA shows emissions increased statewide from 2003 to 2004. Northwest Environment Watch said this is a, quote, astonishingly successful program, end quote. Pollution releases by industry throughout the state have dropped since the earliest reports in 1988. The program, called the Toxics Release Inventory, requires large volume industrial polluters to report to the EPA their emissions for specific pollutants, including cancer-causing chemicals, or pollutants that build up in people and animals such as dioxins, mercury, and lead. The inventory tracks whether the chemicals are released into the air, water, or land. The EPA now plans to scale back the program, this from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer.
Red and gold Chinese flags drape some streets in anticipation of Chinese President Hu Jintao's two-day stop here this week. But some residents are unhappy the city and state are rolling out the red carpet. Hundreds of demonstrators were expected downtown after Hu's scheduled arrival tomorrow. Practitioners of Falun Gong, a spiritual movement labeled an evil cult in China, announced a protest against oppression. Other critics include Taiwanese Americans who assert that the island's independent status and Tibetans who have called for an end to China's rule of their homeland. But for many, Hu's visit, his first stop before going to Washington, D.C., is good news.
Bellevue Community College Board of Trustees issued a statement Saturday condemning the behavior of an instructor who wrote a racially insulting math question recently brought to the college's attention by students. Excuse me. The statement issued afterwards said the instructor demonstrated, quote, gross violations of BCC's mission and core value of respect for diversity, end quote. It asked that the curriculum and practice of all departments be examined to ensure unacceptable negative stereotypes are eliminated. The question began, Condoleezza holds a watermelon just over the edge of the roof of a 300-foot federal building and tosses it up with a velocity of 20 feet per second. It went on to ask when the watermelon would hit the ground based on a formula provided. The college's statement said the question demeaned U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who is black. The racist connotation stems from negative caricatures of blacks eating watermelon during the days of plantation slavery. This from the Seattle Times.
A Navy reservist faces a maximum 10 years in prison if convicted of smuggling Indian and Pakistani nationals into the country from British Columbia. This from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Lawrence Carter of Oak Harbor pleaded not guilty in U.S. District Court in Seattle to one count of smuggling and transporting illegal immigrants. He's one of the 14 men from Washington and Canada indicted by a federal grand jury accused of bringing 54 people who had paid as much as $35,000 apiece into this country illegally. Investigators believe Carter worked as a driver in the smuggling ring. Carter's attorney, Pete Mazzoni, said Carter was honorable discharge from the Navy in July. Investigators start tracking the Vancouver, BC-based operation in January 2005 after getting a tip that three men had bought maps of the border and had asked the Border Patrol and Canadian police enforcement activity in the area. Days later, Border Patrol agents stopped a minivan carrying 10 illegal aliens near the Orville port of entry. The van was registered to a man investigators believe was the ringleader, Cavill Multaney. Multaney is a dual Canadian-Indian citizen living in Vancouver, charged with 9 counts of smuggling and transporting illegal immigrants.
The Supreme Court will hear arguments today about what legal standards should be used to evaluate changes made by supervisors following a discrimination complaint by an employee. Retaliation claims have risen dramatically, and the High Court's decision could affect the balance of power in government and private workplaces nationwide. Businesses say they'll be hurt if justices create a super protected class of employees who can't be disciplined or transferred after filing a complaint. But labor unions and women's groups say workers should not be pressured to remain silent with threats of schedule changes or transfers. The Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway Company wants justices to overturn an appeals court decision involving a female forklift operator who complained of sexual harassment. The court ruled suspending the woman without pay and transferring her to a more physically demanding job where materially adverse changes.
A former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff disputes the contention by some retired generals that the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld intimidated top military commanders into silence during planning for the invasion of Iraq. The counter-critic's description of Rumsfeld as a micromanager who did not listen to military leaders. The Pentagon circulated a one-page memo late last week detailing the Defense Secretary's frequent contacts with numerous uninformed and civilian advisors. Retired Air Force General Richard Myers denied yesterday that military leaders failed to speak up when they disagreed with Rumsfeld and President Bush. A half dozen retired generals have called for Rumsfeld's ouster, citing mistakes in the conduct of war in Iraq. Some have suggested that intimidation by Rumsfeld kept military leaders quiet, even when they thought policies were flawed. But retired Marine Lieutenant General Michael DeLong said today that he suspected Rumsfeld's critics simply didn't like Rumsfeld's management style and personality.
The Reverend Joseph Lowry yesterday urged war protesters camping near President Bush's ranch to keep working for peace. Lowry co-founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference with Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. He spoke at a Sunrise Interfaith Easter Sunday service. Lowry said after the service that he sees many parallels between the civil rights movement and the peace movement, so he decided to miss a traditional Easter church service for the first time. Lowry spoke on the last day of the group's third protest in less than a year near Bush's ranch. Bush spent the holiday at Camp David, his first Easter away from the ranch since he was elected. The vigil attracted thousands of fellow demonstrators and grew to a second larger camp on a private lot where the group returned for a Thanksgiving week protest and the Easter week activities. The peace vigil also drew scores of counter-protests by Bush supporters who said Sheehan was disgracing fallen soldiers and hurting troop morale. But Sheehan, who plans to return to Crawford in August, said she believes the anti-war demonstrations have made a difference.
Along a gritty stretch of street in Brooklyn, police this month quietly launched an ambitious plan to combat street crime and terrorism. But instead of cops on the beat, wireless video cameras peered down from lampposts about 30 feet above the sidewalk. They were the first installments of a program to place 500 cameras throughout the city at a cost of $9 million. Hundreds of additional cameras could follow if the city receives $81.5 million in federal grants and has requested to safeguard Lower Manhattan and parts of Midtown with a surveillance ring of steel model after security measures in London's financial district. Officials of the New York Police Department claim the money would be well spent, especially since the revelation that Al-Qaeda members once cased the New York Stock Exchange and other financial institutions. The city already has about 1,000 cameras in the subways, with 2,100 scheduled to be in place by 2008. An additional 3,100 cameras monitor city housing projects. Police officials insist that law-abiding New Yorkers have nothing to fear because the cameras will be restricted to public areas. The police commissioner recently established a panel of four corporate defense lawyers to advise the department on surveillance policies.
Retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner claimed that U.S. military operations are already underway inside Iran, according to Raw Story. Gardiner designed a war game in November of 2004 for Atlantic Magazine, which simulated preparations for a U.S. assault on Iran. He also claimed that Alishagar Soltanaya, the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency, told him a few weeks ago that units who had attacked the Revolutionary Guard had been captured and confessed to working with Americans. Raw Story reported last Thursday that the Pentagon has been using a right-wing terrorist organization known as Mujahideen-e-Khalq as an operational asset to, quote, create strife in Iran in preparation for a possible attack, end quote. Rumsfeld, under instructions from Cheney, began using the group on special ops missions to Iran to pave the way for a potential Iran strike.
The Pentagon is bypassing official U.S. intelligence channels and turning to a dangerous and early cast of characters in order to create strife in Iran, in preparation for a possible attack, according to the Raw Story. One of the operational assets being used by the Defense Department is a right-wing terrorist organization known as Mujahideen-e-Khalq, which is being run in two southern regional areas of Iran. There are Balochistan, a Sunni stronghold, a Khuzestan and Shia region where a series of recent attacks has left many dead and hundreds injured in the last 3 months. One former counterintelligence official who wished to remain anonymous due to the sensitivity of the information describes the Pentagon as pushing Meek shortly after an invasion of Iraq in 2003. The drive to use the insurgents group was said to have been advanced by Pentagon under the influence of the Vice President of Office and opposed by the State Department, National Security Council, and then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. A UN official told a Raw Story, "We are already at war." The UN official explained that the Khuzestan war had been going on for roughly a year and included an unmanned drone run jointly by several agencies.
The new U.S. embassy in Iraq seems as cloaked in secrecy as the ministrate in Rome. The fortress-like compound rising beside the Tigris River will be the largest of its kind in the world, with a population of a small town, its own defense force, self-contained power and water, and a precarious perch at the heart of Iraq's turbulent future. A British tabloid even told readers the location was being kept secret, news that would surprise Baghdadis who for months have watched the forest of construction cranes at work across the winding Tigris at the very center of their city and within easy mortar range of anti-U.S. forces in the capital. The embassy complex, 21 buildings on 104 acres, is taking shape on Riverside Parkland in the fortified Green Zone, just east of Al Samoud, a former palace of Saddam Hussein's. The Republican Palace, where the U.S. Embassy functions, are temporarily housed in cubicles among the chandelier-hung rooms, is less than a mile away from the four-square-mile zone, an enclave of American and Iraqi government offices and lodgings ringed by miles of concrete barriers. The 5,500 Americans and Iraqis working at the embassy, almost half listed as security, are far more numerous than any other U.S. mission worldwide.
Iraqi leaders yesterday postponed a parliament session after failing to agree on a prime minister. The action is a setback in Iraqi's efforts to form a unity government. Bombs targeted Shiites near a mosque and on a bus attacks nationwide killed at least 35 people. Four more Marines were reported killed in fighting west of Baghdad as U.S. death toll for this month rose to 47, compared with 31 for all of March. U.S. officials believe the best way to stem the violence is for the Iraqis to establish a government comprising Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds, paving the way for the United States to start withdrawing its 133,000 troops. But progress has stalled over Sunni and Kurdish opposition to the Shiites' choice of Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jaafar to head the new government, with al-Jaafar refusing to step aside. Acting Speaker Adnan Pashki called a parliament session for Monday, hoping the full legislature could agree on a new leadership after politicians failed. The fight over Al Jafar has heightened friction among the rival parties, raising the specter of deadlock over other top jobs. Some Shiite officials say that if they must exchange their nominee for prime minister, other parties may not win approval of their first choice for major posts either.
Thousands rallied on the weekend in Chad's capital to support the president following a defeated rebel attack. At the same time, the oil minister threatened to shut down the country's oil pipeline unless the government is compensated for frozen oil revenues. President Idriss Deby's government appears desperate to attract international attention to solve Chad's political, economic, and security problems. Oil Minister Mahat Hassan Nasser said the pipeline would be shut down unless the international community ensured Chad received its oil royalties by midday Tuesday. Chad's oil exports are small by international standards and have a high sulfur content, reducing their value, but Deby appeared to be gambling that any threat to the world oil supply, no matter how small, will bring attention to his plight and free up needed money to finance his government. The warning came a day after Deby announced that he was severing relations with neighboring Sudan and threatened to expel 200,000 refugees from the Darfur region if the international community did not do more to stop what he complained were Sudanese-backed rebels from destabilizing his government before the presidential election.
A Palestinian suicide bomber blew himself outside a fast food restaurant in a bustling commercial area of Tel Aviv during the Passover holiday today. Seven people were killed and at least 49 were wounded. It was the first suicide attack in Israel since the Hamas militant group took over the Palestinian government 2.5 weeks ago. Hamas has largely observed a ceasefire since February 2005. The Islamic Jihad militant group claimed responsibility. The attack came after the group pledged to carry out more attacks. Islamic Jihad has claimed responsibility for all six of the previous suicide attacks inside Israel since the ceasefire was declared. Hamas leaders called the bombing a legitimate response to Israel's aggression, a sharp departure from the previous Palestinian leadership's immediate condemnation of such attacks. Earlier, Musa Abu Mazouk, a Hamas leader, told Al Jazeera television that Israel's side must feel that what the Palestinians feels, and the Palestinians defend themselves as much as he can.
Russia said it has pledged urgent financial assistance to the Hamas-led Palestinian government despite an international boycott. The Russian Foreign Ministry did not say how much money it offered. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, quote, expressed great appreciation, end quote, for the pledge, which was conveyed by Foreign Ministry Sergei Lavrov, ministry said. The European Union last week froze hundreds of millions of dollars in annual direct aid to the Palestinian government. The United States and Canada have also halted government aid, and the U.S. this week barred Americans from most dealings with the Palestinian government.
Iran is saying that it would give $50 million in aid to the Hamas-led Palestinian government after the United States and the European Union froze their aid. Iran's foreign minister, Mahathir Mohtaka, announced a donation of the last day of a pro-Palestinian conference. The European suspended its $600 million aid package, the United States a $400 million donation after Hamas unexpectedly electoral victory in January. The measures were aimed at increasing pressure on the militant Palestinian group to renounce violence and to recognize Israel. The three-day conference here brought together some 600 Palestinian militant leaders and their supporters from Muslim countries. The exiled Hamas political leader Khalid Mishael said Saturday at the conference that his government would never recognize Israel. He also said that the government needed $170 million a month, out of which $115 million would go toward paying salaries. But Mishael said the government has not only inherited empty treasure, but also $1.7 billion in debts.
The Nepalese capital ran low on fresh food and fuel yesterday because of a general strike that shut down the city. Thousands of angry pro-democracy demonstrators clashed with police firing rubber bullets. The emboldened opposition urged Nepalese to stop paying taxes to the government of King Gyanendra, who responded by further banning protests on the capital's outskirts. Yesterday's pro-democracy rallies across Nepal attracted tens of thousands of people and were the biggest since opponents of Gyanendra's royal dictatorship began their campaign of protests and a nationwide strike that has cut off Nepal's cities for 11 days. The rallies included small protests in Kathmandu's tourist hub and commercial heart, the first in the capital's center where rallies are banned. In Kathmandu, many of the capital's 1.5 million residents struggled to find everything from fresh vegetables to gasoline.
The U.S. military has admitted killing 7 civilians during a battle with insurgents in Afghanistan. A statement regretting the loss, quote, loss of innocent life, end quote, announcing an investigation was released by the U.S. The deaths occurred during a firefight between a coalition patrol and up to 10 militants in Kunar province near the border with Pakistan. The clash interrupted during a major operation launched by the U.S.-led coalition against the Taliban forces. There has been fighting in the southern province of Zabul between Taliban and police manning a checkpoint. There are unconfirmed claims of dead and injured on both sides. The civilian deaths happened in the Korangal Valley when American troops responded to an attack by militant firing small arms and rocket-propelled grenades, said U.S. military spokesman Major Matt Hockenthorne. Artillery and air support were called in. U.S. and Afghan forces last week launched Operation Mountain Lion, involving 2,500 troops to flush out Taliban-led militants assumed to be behind a recent upsurge in attacks on both coalition forces and civilians.
An explosion has injured 31 people in a residential suburb of Istanbul, according to the BBC. Turkish media say police suspect the blast in the Bakirkoy district of the city's European side was caused by a bomb left in a rubbish bin near a shop. Several bombs have been planted in Istanbul recently, thought to be linked to unrest in the Kurdish southeast. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the latest explosion, which occurred on a busy street. Kurdish militants have left bombs in Istanbul and threatened more attacks after recent violence in the mainly Kurdish southeast of the country. A separatist group, the Kurdish Freedom Falcons, has said it carried out some of the explosions. It has links to the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, which began an armed struggle in southeastern Turkey in the mid-1980s. Tensions between the Ankara government and the PKK have risen since 2004 when the group called off a five-year ceasefire.
This has been the KBOO News for Monday, April 17, 2006. Thanks for listening. This program is edited by Chris Andrea. Audio engineers are Jim Thompson and Matt Bingley. The tape stories were edited by KBOO volunteers. KBOO reporters contributed to this program. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm LaToya Hudson.
And I'm Arlise Franklin.
We clear the air at 90.7 FM. Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis, on the translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River, on the translator K220HR. Portland area weather today, partly cloudy with a chance of showers, highs 50 to 55. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows in the 30s.